Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is another episode in the Venice Film Festival series. It's already a few days into the festival, so there will probably by now be a number of movies you've already heard a little bit about. I'm very pleased to do the second episode with returning guest, and also previously Cannes, Venice, and Berlin.
And Berlin. I think yes, we've done the trifecta.
We have done the trifecta, yeah. Guy Lodge, hello.
Always a pleasure.
Yes. For this festival, you'll be filing for Variety?
For Variety and some for my own site, Film of the Week.
Oh, yeah. Film of the Week, yeah. We're going to start with, I guess, what was for me, I have to admit, like a kind of unexpected hit from the early days. I watched this movie a little earlier than the festival, and I thought, oh, man, I'd really love to write about this, but is this just going to be too outré? But I guess not.
Yeah, it's went over kind of like gangbusters here, yeah. Which I mean I saw it for the first time yesterday, but as I was watching it, I was really loving it, but I was also like, I have no idea. You know, there could be boos at the end, there could be rapturous applause, or anything in between. As turned out, there was rapturous applause. I suppose we should say the film that we're about is Yorgos Lanthimos's Poor Things.
Yes, Poor Things. Which is an adaptation of a book I haven't read, but now I'm kind of curious to read it.
You should. It's very different, but an equally kind of weird animal. But yeah, weird in its own ways.
Yeah.
By Alistair Gray, which is kind of a kind of cult object in particularly in Scotland.
Oh, really?
Because it's entirely set in Glasgow, which the film is not, and I'm sure the Scots are going to be very upset that it's being kind of taken away from them. But I think if they can get past that, they'll be happy with the adaptation.
Yeah. Well, you want to give like a quick overview of what the story is?
I mean, the book is, you know, takes place in this highly kind of stylized literary kind of book within a book format.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, the series of kind of medical journals and diaries. And it's all kind of revolves around this odd kind of Victorian era medical case experiment, which, you know, the longer you look into it, the more you see it's kind of a riff on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein,
right.
Which is a kind of reclusive, you know, brilliant reclusive surgeon living in the film in London, is raising a young woman who appears to have the literal mind of a child. When played by Emma Stone, her name is Bella Baxter. And when we encounter her, you know, she's a fully grown woman, but she moves, talks, kind of thinks, reasons like a toddler. Which is, you know, very, very kind of disorienting. And I think it'd be best not to kind of reveal the exact way she came to be or why she is like this, but there's a whole kind of twisty backstory there.
Yeah.
You know, whereas the young kind of research assistant that the surgeon, kind of beautifully played by Willem Dafoe, takes on, the research assistant played by Rami Youssef, this young guy initially assumes that she's mentally disabled, which is not exactly the case, because as it turns out, she's just still growing. And she grows quite kind of rapidly before our eyes, not physically, but in terms of her kind of mental development, her vocabulary, her kind of sexual awareness, which eventually becomes the kind of whole crux of the film. And, you know, eventually she kind of leaves the nest and goes out into the great wide world to discover what's out there and what her place in it is. And it's quite a journey.
Yeah, it is. And she does that with kind of wily help of Mark Ruffalo's character. He's a lawyer.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess that was also one thing that I wasn't sure people were going to get around, but I guess people kind of cruised right past. But the fact is that initially he's kind of taking advantage of her.
Yes.
From the outset. She was there for business with Willem Dafoe's character,
whose name is Godwin, and she calls him God, which is quite telling throughout, I think.
Yeah, she's quoting God quite a lot. But I was just, I mean, even just on a basic physical level, you mentioned how she's a child in sort of capacity and also the way she moves. And it just seemed clear that Emma Stone had been studying toddler movements.
You know, yes.
She just has it down.
Yeah, I mean, this is a character arc that I don't think any actor has, you know, ever really had to essay before in quite the way that she does. I mean, this is, you know, it's kind of a dream role for any actor, because she literally has to, you know, grow up from, you know, from cradle to adulthood within one body.
Yeah.
And it's kind of extraordinary to watch. And I think she is, really, really remarkable in it. And and she's always been a very gifted comedian, but I think the kind of the physical comedy required of her kind of here is, you know, not something she's done before. And she absolutely just jumps into it with such relish. I think she's extraordinary.
Yeah, I agree. And she has a lot of fun with the dialogue, which starts off, I mean, it's like, what is it, Dubliners or something? Or
yes.
What's the book where the language develops as this?
Exactly, yeah. And it's written by Tony McNamara, who also wrote The Favourite and has a sort of similarly kind of lascivious sense of humour kind of throughout. You can see that obviously he and Yorgos really kind of hit it off and seem to groove together well.
Yeah, and I guess a number of people have been saying that it helps that when he's working with another screener, not just himself, you know, again and again in his movies, he returns this tabula rasa kind of setup where you have a character who, for one reason or another, usually pretty outlandish reasons, is starting from zero, basically, or in terms of knowledge of the world. And this is the case here, but I think here, instead of feeling, I guess partly because of the trajectory of the character, it doesn't feel as conceptual or constricted or severe in a kind of semi-pointless way as his other ones. So I just found it, I hate the word humanist, but it is kind of his most humanist movie in a way.
Yeah, I mean, as bizarre and as extremely horny and and generally kind of off-kilter the whole thing is, there is, an odd kind of undertow of sweetness to it almost. And especially as, you know, as we watch Bella, Emma Stone's character, develop and come into her own and gradually kind of gain self-awareness and a sense of kind of who she is and what the world is around her, we really feel for her. I mean, she's not just a kind of a stunt or a joke character. Mm-hmm. She's incredibly kind of fully formed and very affecting.
Yeah, it's one of the more effective types of stories that also becomes this like feminist fable. I guess one comparison has, because Barbie just happened, that this is, you know, something that you could more easily call subversive than Barbie in a way.
Yeah, and it really, her whole kind of coming of age trajectory, because this is essentially a coming of age story. It's just that she looks like an adult from the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's, it is kind of entirely initially premised on her sexual awakening, and you kind of, when she discovers what's between her legs and what she can do with it. And she has this sort of great line, I think, after the first time she and Mark Ruffalo have, you know, very raucous sex, she's like, why don't people do this all the time? And gradually kind of learns the answer to that with, you know, with less happy kind of encounters as she goes from London to Lisbon to Egypt to Paris. It's a whole, it's a sort of very kind of 19th century style sort of voyage as well.
And I think a key to that voyage and to her sexual discovery is that the screenplay doesn't have a logic of debasement or self-abasement or something. It's not making that play out, which all too often is what movies that take a character who's like, I don't know, because I've always, at certain points, I've gotten kind of frustrated with what's a kind of common art film gambit, which is to take a character and take something away from them and then just put them through the paces of something and put them through the gauntlet. But I think, this movie does much more than that.
Yeah, it's not a nihilistic film at all, but there's also kind of no moral judgment to it at all.
Yeah.
I mean, everything that she does and everything that she goes through, and some of it is what most people would kind of think of as kind of sleazy or degrading in many ways, but it's all like, well, this is just part of her kind of character building and part of her experience, and she doesn't kind of regret any of it, which is so interesting. She sort of, you know, she becomes a woman who kind of just says yes to everything because she wants to see what will happen. And that obviously just makes for great drama.
It's true. Yes and taken to an extreme. I mean, she loves God, meaning Godwin, and so she really loves his scientific method. So she has that, partly that mindset as well. She's like, oh, I wonder what will happen if I do this, which is also a form of openness.
Yeah, there is a fantastic scene when she's still sort of at toddler development level of her kind of working alongside him in his surgery, where she just gets a cadaver to play with and, you know, kind of flaps around with his penis and stabs his eyes with a scalpel the way a kind of child would sort of scribble on a drawing pad. It's she just nails those moments. She makes them so kind of warmly hilarious, actually.
She really does. And I guess it's also worth mentioning just the production, which takes the movie to another level as well. I mean,
the design kind of components are really extraordinary. Yeah. It's interesting. It's got two production designers who are kind of working. They're not usual collaborators, but Yorgos obviously wanted kind of both their kind of sensibilities. And it's a film that's so kind of busy and almost kind of top heavy with visual ideas, and from like very old fashioned, you know, physical set building and kind of matte painting to very kind of sophisticated digital effects work to kind of create this very distorted sense of the world, like a kind of child still moving through it. And Robbie Ryan, the great cinematographer who worked on The Favourite as well, as with The Favourite, often kind of resorts to kind of fisheye lenses and wide angle things, which is not usually my favourite technique.
Yeah.
But here kind of feels very appropriate because it kind of conveys the perspective of someone who's just trying to kind of look in all directions at all times and just see as much of what's around her as possible in kind of one take.
Yeah. It also does something which I like with kind of historical movies, which is kind of restoring the strangeness to a historical moment. Because I don't, you know, it shouldn't feel familiar, you know, like the first thing that would strike you if you were transported this time is probably the smell, which we can never get in the movies. But anyway, but like they travel someplace at one point in a carriage, but it's actually like a horseless carriage. But it's one of those that must have been just during the transition to cars, because it still has like a vestigial horse head on it. You know, the moment where I don't know if people are going to accept cars, but we'll put a horse in. So just things to remind you of like...
Yeah, which kind of matches with Godwin's weird animal experiments as well.
That's true, know? Yeah.
He loves a good dissection, you know. And it's there's so many... you know, good kind of throwaway visual gags like that, and so much kind of wit in just the general kind of aesthetic and mise-en-scène of it. And and I think Lanthimos has always been a really kind of interesting visual stylist, but, you know, he used to be quite ascetic, and obviously his early Greek films, he was, you know, working on a tight budget, and, you know, the kind of minimalism fitted that. And now he's, I don't know what the budget of this film is, but it looks more expensive than it is, I suppose, because he's just thrown everything at the wall. And I kind of like this new maximalist thing for him.
Yeah, me too. And in the credit sequence, I got the sense that there are all these beautiful textures. And I got the sense like they're like, we just got to shoot more of our sets because we have some great stuff here. Because it's just every single page is another. I just stayed. I mean, I always kind of stay for the credits anyway, but this time I was like, goggle eye.
They're virtually unreadable, but they're the most beautiful closing credits I've ever seen. And even like, you know, the film has kind of chapter headings throughout, and every one of them is kind of accompanied by a kind of surrealist tableau with Emma Stone floating somewhere, and it's just all this kind of slightly excess ornamentation which fits the film's just general sense of central kind of overwhelmment.
This was screened on the same day as Aggro Drift, so it was kind of a very like maximalist kind of, you know, pushing cinema to new limits kind of day. This is not a transition to Aggro Drift, which we'll talk about here. We'll get to that eventually. But yeah, I was so happy about Poor Things, and also happy that people have embraced it.
It seems to be the clear kind of hit of the festival so far. I've yet to talk to someone who doesn't like it. I mean, I'm sure those people will emerge. And, you know, I'm sure many of our moms won't love it, but, you know, I've always been a fan of Lanthimos, but I think this is kind of him pushing himself to a new level.
And also, having seen a few already, like Willem Dafoe movies this year, it's his best, you know, by far. Yeah, so that's Poor Things, needless to say, a competition title. A movie that is out of competition, although I guess previously his movies here have been in competition.
They have, yeah.
So I don't know that necessarily means anything. Is the next Frederick Wiseman movie, which I have not seen, so I'm just going to sit here and listen to the meal of the movie.
Yes, Frederick Wiseman's new film, and I'll try to get the French title right, Menu Plaisir, Les Trois Gros, which is another institutional study, which, you know, he loves and we love for him, where he examines one body, whether it's, you know, the National Gallery or the New York Library or whatever, and kind of examines its workings and human makeup from the inside out. And in this case, he's picked a 3 Michelin star restaurant in the French countryside, long established family business that has been going for almost 90 years and is now kind of regarded as one of the world's great restaurants. It's in, or rather just outside Roanne, in this idyllic valley of farmland and you know, surrounded by kind of many of their own kind of suppliers of vegetables and meat and ingredients. It is 4 hours long, which is, you know, no great surprise from Wiseman. And I kind of think it's almost like the documentary counterpart to this year's big Cannes hit, Le Pot au Feu.
Oh, yeah.
Or The Taste of Things, as it's been very unfortunately recited in the US.
Yeah.
in that it's a very devoted study of haute cuisine and the human love and labor that goes into it. And how much you respond to it or stick with it will very much depend on, you know, your own interest in that whole world and in your literal palate, I suppose.
Right.
It was very much for me. I mean, this is, I think, it's basically the first test, basically, is the film opens with, I think, 6-7 minute scene of chefs just wandering around a morning farmer's market picking out herbs and lettuce and you know, the camera kind of lingering on these exquisite ingredients that they're picking out. And I was enthralled by that. I think if you're kind of dozing off by that point, you're probably be best off leaving, because it's, you know, it's not going to be for you, and that's fine. But once we kind of get into the establishment itself and we kind of gradually kind of discover, it's interesting kind of power hierarchy, because it is a family business. It's the sort of head chef there, Michel, who inherited it from his own father and his grandfather before him, and now has two sons who work as chefs kind of below him, who are starting to challenge him on many things and have, you know, different ideas and different recipes they want to try out. And there's kind of great love between all of them, but there's an interesting, what drives the film through its, you know, very kind of languid running time is this gentle conflict between them, and the sense of a kind of generational handover in this otherwise very old school, extremely French establishment. I mean, this is, you know, this is a restaurant where all the chefs wear literal 2-foot-high white hats, and, you know, everything is spotless and everything is immaculate, and they, you know, assemble the plates with tweezers, and you know, and there are foams and mousselines and every kind of pastry you could imagine. And there's one just wonderful shot. A chef just rolls out a giant kind of meter wide roll of like phyllo pastry and just flaps out towards the camera like a sort of someone unrolling a red carpet. And I was like, yes. It's just very sexy.
Well, yeah, I was sort of wondering about that, like how he films food in this, because there's actually not, I mean, not to generalize, but I really don't remember a whole lot of food in a lot of his films.
Yeah, and he's a person who's interested in kind of human process and, yeah, an institutional process. He's not really a big kind of sensual, he's not a sensualist. He doesn't make lots of time in his films for kind of excess pleasure. But the way he films food here is both as kind of pragmatic and process-oriented as you would expect. I mean, you know, the camera just watches these plates as they're gradually kind of assembled from the ground up. But there is joy in it as well, and a kind of real appreciation of beauty. I mean, these kind of extraordinary creations that are not only assembled before our eyes, but we kind of see the whole process from conceptualization, where they first pitch their recipe ideas and debate them and, you know, argue about whether this ingredient would be too much in it or that, and then go through the tasting process, and until it eventually, in a form they all agree on, you know, makes it to the dining room. And, you know, it's highly methodical, it's highly specialized and specific. But if you've ever paged through a cookbook and just to look at the pictures, then there will be a lot of reward for you here.
Yeah.
I mean, I was my notes that I was taking throughout eventually just devolve into basically just recipes and like listing a menu. It's like, ooh, what did he say? Was it cumin and miso? It's like, need to write that down. Need to try that. Yeah, and it's not as politically substantial as many of his films. It's you know, it's not deep. It very much is what it is. It's a study of a restaurant. But I, one, just learned a lot from it, because we also have other sections where we, you know, where they go to kind of visit the farms and the dairies and where they kind of get their ingredients from. There's a whole kind of sequence where in a goat cheese factory where the kind of proprietor talks us through the process of making it, and I was just like, oh, that's how. So yeah, if any of this sounds interesting to you, then I recommend you see it. If you're bored stiff just listening to me talk about it, then yeah, give it a wide berth.
Well, I mean, just superficially, it sounds like a movie that happens to intersect, you know, with general interests that are out there now, whether it's The Bear or whatever the latest wave of
exactly
shows are.
I mean, I think actually what is interesting about it is it proves the lie of so many hyped up cooking competition shows, or even kind of cooking dramas like The Bear or films like Boiling Point, which are always so full of conflict and shouting and sort of you know, the whole kind of Gordon Ramsay cliche of kind of, you know, the terrifying head chef and petrified minions. Because what's striking throughout Menu Plaisir is how quiet it is, and how even at the sort of most tense points of the kitchen, where, you know, where they're putting together this, you know, 8-course tasting menu for 70 covers or whatever it is, there's just a smooth calmness to the way they work together. And even when they argue about stuff, it's, you know, when one junior chef, you know, messes up cooking the lamb's brains, you know, the head chef does not like bawl him out. He kind of sits him down and takes out the Larousse Gastronomique and explains to him, no, this is how you do it. And I like to think that's how most kitchens would actually work.
Right. Yeah. As opposed to the, yeah, pressure cooker drama every second. I mean, just conceptually, I'm also very curious about it, because since a lot of his movies deal with institutions and kind of permanence in that way, or this one, it's inherently about an art form that in its manifestation is ephemeral,
yeah,
although the recipes have a continuity to them. So I'm sure that must be something that he's sort of implicitly interested in there. Although now that I think about it, a lot of public institutions are also doing things that are kind of not ephemeral, yeah, but kind of fluid.
Yeah, and it's what makes the kind of family aspect of the film so kind of interesting, and eventually in its own quiet way rather moving, because there's obviously things that are going to be lost in the eventual kind of generational handover, and certain traditions that will be kept. And, you know, it's up to the two sons, or eventually one son, who kind of takes the lead to decide what those are going
to
be.
Yeah. For some reason, I flashed in my head to a early review I remember writing, Jiro Dreams of Sushi. Do you remember
yes,
that one?
Yeah.
Which also, I think, has a family aspect where the son is taking over and seems kind of none too excited about the whole thing. Well, that is the new Frederick Wiseman movie, the title being what you said earlier.
Menu Plaisir, Les Trois Gros.
So, and that will be making its way through other festivals in the fall. And Poor Things is, just to mention, is coming out in December in the US.
Yes,
is
they kind of kicked it back, didn't they?
Yeah.
I think it was going to come out in September, and then maybe they realized they had more of an awards play on their hands than they thought.
That's so... I always like to talk about one movie that, you know, maybe isn't being splashed about as much. Not that The Wiseman is being like shouted at the rooftops, but for me it is. And, you know, here they have a Horizons section that's a sidebar, and also, you know, a Critics Week, and also something called Venice Days.
And Horizons is sort of like to Venice what Uncertain Regard is to Cannes.
That's right. That's and City of Wind is a Mongolian production. Yeah. So that's pretty rare. I also saw a whole bunch of different nationalities and the names involved, which is kind of cool. And the basic premise was very interesting to me, about a young man who's a shaman.
Yes. Very young, we should say. He's, what, 17? Yeah.
Yeah, he's in high school. And so the opening few scenes, I mean, you know, you see him at his calling as a shaman, but also you see him in class with, like, people teasing each other and showing YouTube videos.
And where he's not an especially kind of remarkable kid. He's just a regular, slightly gawky, slightly awkward high schooler.
Yeah.
And yet when he puts on this incredible shaman outfit with the forward-facing wig and this headdress and about, you know, 600 necklaces of beads and feathers and whatever else, he sort of does enter another realm.
Yeah, he is transformed, and I guess part of the spiritual process is he's either channeling, I mean, I should read up on this, but he is becoming or bringing forth someone else. I guess they call it like a grandfather.
Yeah, the grandfather spirit.
The grandfather spirit, and he even adopts a different voice to do this. Yeah. Although there's another character who's completely skeptical about the whole thing, which is kind of an interesting perspective to have too. But this is one that you liked as well. Yeah.
Very much so. I mean, it was not on my radar at all. And it was actually our friend Jessica Kiang who saw it earlier in Berlin and was like, it's lovely, see it if you can. Wow. And I'm very glad I did, because I think it's a total charmer. That's kind of done a disservice by its title as well, because City of Wind sort of just sounds like one of those boilerplate kind of art house,
yeah,
kind of slow cinema things that, you know, could be anything really. And what I love about the film is kind of how strange and particular it is, and it's kind of a mixture of a fairly conventional high school rom-com almost, but then kind of mixed with this incredibly specific cultural context, mm-hmm. which also kind of frames the protagonist's kind of dilemma completely differently, because mm-hmm. he does wind up having a kind of crisis of faith and a kind of crisis of what his calling actually is.
Yeah.
You know, when this more skeptical character, as you said earlier, is another young woman who he kind of meets mm-hmm. on the job when she's kind of very reluctantly sent to be shamanized, and he develops this fascination with her, and she eventually with him wondering basically why on earth he's doing this, and they find in each other sanctuary.
Yeah.
And it's very tender and very moving.
Yeah, and she's an interesting character too. She's kind of like a self-proclaimed like misfit for the world in a believable way, which is she wants to get out of town, yeah, for one thing, but you know, she's also kind of self-described, just has problems with lots of things, and yeah, you know, is a kind of critical and an interesting way. So it's interesting to see them find a way of matching up. And yeah, he also, the shaman, has a self-discovery along the lines a little bit. Poor Things.
Yes.
As well.
Yes.
Without giving too much away.
Two very, very different coming of age stories.
Yeah.
And I kind of roll my eyes a bit whenever I kind of hear the term coming of age now.
I know, it's so funny.
We kind of associate it with so many kind of generic Sundance style kind of indies that are kind of ten a penny. And here are two that are, you know, completely stand out from the crowd and are doing their own thing.
Yeah. And just also a quick word about City of Wind. The cinematography is just, you know, luminous, and they really make an effort to transport you into the moment of,
yeah,
when he is being a shaman.
And there's a really kind of just rich sense of place to it as well. I mean, he lives in this completely unremarkable, fairly squat little town in the middle of the desert. But there is a strange surrealism to the almost kind of suburban normality of his immediate surroundings, yeah, with the kind of desolate, isolated quality of what's right around them.
Yeah.
And I think the film and its framing in particular takes advantage of that.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed it out. You know, whether they're in a mall or the way they often frame like the bustling aspect of the city and what's in the foreground. At one point they talk about like, where would you want to live? And like, he's looking at a high rise and she's, yeah, you know. And it's funny, I think it was this past year or the previous year at IDFA, I saw a documentary shot in Mongolia in the 90s, I think shortly after the Soviet Union's like sphere of influence was not quite as strong, I guess. And a lot of the same things were in play of,
yeah,
like rural and yeah, like a lot of places had a lot of upheaval. But this movie, I think, shows this without, you know, it feeling laborious or,
yeah,
anything. It more kind of, it's embodied in their experiences.
Yeah, and I think for anyone who thinks Mongolia doesn't have much to do with their own life, I think watch it and be surprised.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, yeah, definitely. City of Wind, and I seem to remember, I mean, from what the original title looked like, it might be more interesting, but now I can't remember what it was. City of Wind will probably stick, just as The Taste of Things is happening.
Yeah, there's a lot of unfortunate retitling going on at this festival. It's like the Mads Mikkelsen film in competition, where the Danish title, which is fantastic, is just The Bastard.
Yeah, that's right.
And then they've called it The Promised Land. I mean, which movie would you rather see?
It's true. Yeah, that would be much better. And just one more movie, which I haven't seen, a Hungarian film that I think, you know, some people were very curious about. The director is Gábor Reich. Is that right? Gábor, yep, Reich. And it's a 2.5-hour film from Hungary. So what is this one about?
Yeah, another teen-focused story, actually, about a high schooler in Budapest who is going through his final exams, which constitute, under the Hungarian system, a fairly crucial oral exam on which whether you pass or fail, kind of everything hangs. And there's kind of much build up to this and many shifting perspectives. You know, we spend time with his very vehemently right-wing dad and his very liberal history teacher and his very gifted best friend and would-be girlfriend if he had his way. But she is instead pining after the history teacher. So all these kind of different perspectives and little crises are all rotating around each other. But it pivots on this exam where he is, you know, he's not the brightest, he's not very well prepared, and he freezes at the exam and fails. And to avoid the wrath of his dad, he says that he failed because he was penalized because he was wearing a nationalist pin on his jacket. And by strange twist of fate, a reporter gets wind of this story and blows it up into a whole national tabloid scandal. And the film, actually quite convincingly, I think, in this era of social media and particularly kind of right-wing scaremongering, particularly at the level of the education system, it quite convincingly conveys how this tiny, inconsequential incident can kind of reflect the whole state of the nation. And I found it very, very funny in a kind of dryly satirical Eastern European way, but also like quite powerful. Gabor Reis was on my radar like a few years ago. He did a lovely film that was at Carl Vivari called For Some Inexplicable Reason. his title's obviously big on explanation or explication. That was a shaggy quarter-life crisis comedy that I thought was very charming and would travel and then promptly didn't. So I was delighted to kind of see him here. And his form has really evolved from that sort of stage of his career. It's a very structurally ambitious film. It has these kind of staggered perspectives that keep overlapping and then rewinding. And it's very, very kind of beautifully filmed with this constant sort of hazy European summer light that permeates the whole thing, even when the drama is at its most dire. It is too long at 2.5 hours. I wish he had tamed it a bit and could have found a way to cut just some of the sort of overlap and some of the excess. Because I think if we're a bit tighter, I think the film could have more of a future. Because I think it would speak to many people. I mean, I think, you know, there would be a lot of people in the US right now who would find it quite chillingly resonant in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Maybe it's in the same universe as Bad Luck Banging, maybe some parts of it. And Christy Mungiu.
Oh yes, Graduation.
Yeah. Somehow that came to mind as well.
Yeah, he's working in more in the kind of Christian Mungiu register than a Radu Judah kind of one. He doesn't. It's kind of rooted in realism still, but there is that kind of very droll, slightly despairing strain of Eastern European satire that I think is kind of having a moment right now.
And one thing I kept reading in different summaries of it was that in the press conference, Alberto Barbera said it was almost in competition or something like that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know.
It has the sort of scale of something that could be in competition. Yeah. There's always that one film that's sort of kept on the boundary, and then it all depends on, you know, whether they can get Yorgos Lanthimos or not.
Right. Yeah, I think that's the reality of things. Yeah. Well, we can wrap up on that one. Explanation for Everything. And I think we still have like a number of pretty heavy days coming up in terms of movies. I think upcoming, we still have a David Fincher film, Sofia Coppola film,
Ava DuVernay,
Agnieszka Holland as well.
It's a stacked lineup this year.
It really is, yeah. But I'm glad we could give a little glimpse of a few titles. So thanks again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.